Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas is styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
Testing season is right around the corner, and this is when confidence really matters. When kids take time to review key concepts and strengthen their skills before assessments, it can make all the difference. IXL helps reinforce what they're learning right now, so they walk into every test feeling prepared, capable, and confident. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts. Designed for students from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL delivers personalized, interactive practice that adapts to your child's level and pace. It's an easy, effective way to support learning as the school year heads into its final stretch. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests. Proven in all 50 states, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Hi, it's Sierra Miller. I can't wait for you to check out my new collection of shoes and accessories at Designer Shoe Warehouse. If you love shoes as much as I do, then trust me, I got you. From cute sneakerinas to the perfect flip-flops to stunning heels, these shoes are all style, no drama. It's a girl's girl summer, and DSW has just the shoes. Shop the Sierra Miller collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Yo, coming to you from the IAM studios in the heart of Los Angeles, in what was originally episode number 42, an extremely special number for Los Angeles and for In a Minute with Evan Lovett, because this episode was our most listened to episode. And frankly, it's one of the most personally revealing but all encompassing. And if you know number 42, you know it's the jersey of Jackie Robinson. So you know I had to do something special, breaking barriers at an extremely high level from his days at Muir High in Pasadena to UCLA to the Dodgers. One of the most impressive people in LA history. But that's the crux of episode number 42, is trying to take 243 years of modern LA history to build around Mount Rushmore, the Los Angeles Mount Rushmore. Now let me tell you, in LA, there's people that impacted the globe, the universe, art, science, sports, culture. And to choose four names to chisel into one of our glorious sun-swept mountain ranges is a nearly impossible task. But Jackie Robinson inspired the episode. But did he actually make the Mount Rushmore? We'll find out. But first, you know what I got to get to. The sponsor, the people that make this happen. Culver City Toyota, home of great service, great environment, great deals. You know my man George, the GM, is going to give you $500 in dealer cash just for mentioning LA in a minute. But Culver City Toyota continues to give you the best deal on any of their new and pre-owned vehicles. Whether you want a Tacoma, Corolla, Prius, Camry, RAV4, Culver City Toyota has you covered. That's Culver City Toyota right there on Washington Boulevard. They're continually proving that they're the best in town. Culver City Toyota. And back to the concept of the best in town. That's what this Mount Rushmore is. The best in this town of all time. Hopefully this inspires somebody to go get a chisel out the Santa Monica or San Gabriel Mountains and start making some of those big rock faces so we can celebrate yet another enduring Los Angeles monument. This is your LA Mount Rushmore. All right, y'all. Let's get into it. So we start with something that happened in LA this week. What inspired this episode? I was cleaning out my garage with my wife. And I'm talking a major reorg here. It's the only area in the house that was not pristine. My wife is an interior designer, so gotta admit, it's beautiful in our house. She does an awesome job. But the garage, maybe not so much. And going through all these boxes and piles of stuff, I uncovered all kinds of memories, nostalgia, treasures. But the item I was most happy to find was an old newspaper from Brooklyn, published in 1892, called The Joker. Now this was very meaningful to me because the publisher was a man named Abe Lovitch. That was my dad's great-grandfather. So it's worth mentioning that Lovitch was the original family name when my dad's dad's dad immigrated from Russia. And somewhere along the line, that was changed to Lovett. I believe it was before my grandfather on the paternal side. So that would be my great-grandfather. Just a note on that. And he was the publisher of The Joker. And now I'm assuming through heredity and genes, this is the source of my passion for journalism, news, and reporting. And it was very cool to have it framed and moved into the studio, the IM Studios. But what's funny is there's a headline that caught my eye. It says the most important people in Brooklyn. And well, Mount Rushmore wasn't completed until 49 years after that paper was published, not until 1941. So the term didn't exist. But essentially, my great-great-grandfather, Abe Lovitch, had a Mount Rushmore of Brooklyn. But it got me thinking, who are the most important people in L.A.? What would be the L.A. Mount Rushmore? And now, I'm talking about today, but I'm also talking ever in Los Angeles. And let me tell you, this is no joke, pun intended. Get it? The Joker. This was a very, very difficult task. So I do want to put some stipulations around it. And remember, this is my mountain, my rock sculpture. So these are my rules. Here we go. Rule number one. All right. I keep saying ever, but I mean modern LA history. They have to have lived in the 20th century. This eliminates many of the pioneers. And you know, if you've been listening, I'm fascinated with frontier Los Angeles, but it eliminates names and people like William Workman, Antonio Colonel, John Downey, Andrew Boyle, even Biddy Mason, one of my favorite all-time LA historical figures, all eliminated from contention. I do want to make it modern, and I want it to be accessible, if you will. Rule number two, I wanted it to be instantly recognizable LA figures. That means there are people that are perhaps more important, more impactful, that did not make the list. For example, Louis Mayer of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, MGM, or William Fox, the namesake of 20th Century Fox, or D.W. Griffith, film pioneer, not on the mountain. Business leaders, politicians, not on the Mount Rushmore. There are an incredible number of businesses, companies, organizations that came from LA, all of whom had impactful founders and CEOs. I'm talking not just McDonald's brothers and Glenn Bell, but Tom Bradley, Richard Nixon, Antonio Villaraigosa. But my rules, they're not included. And this is going to be a controversial one. I tried not to include people who are overtly entertainers. Now, this is LA after all, so how can you omit any actors and singers? Well, you know what? There's so many people of theater, comedians, actors, singers, quote-unquote celebrities that come from L.A. that unless their impact was profound beyond entertainment, they weren't up for consideration. I'm talking from Charlie Chaplin to John Wayne, Marilyn Monroe to Kim Kardashian, Axl Rose to Snoop Dogg. You will not find them on my Mount Rushmore. And lastly, stipulation number five, and apologies to my brainiac listeners, but scientists did not make the cut. That means Edwin Hubble, who literally discovered the universe, and Leonard Kleinrock, who played a major part in inventing the internet, not on the Mount Rushmore. And one more special apology to William Mulholland, my man, my Halloween costume. The person who probably had the single most profound impact on modern Los Angeles. I mean, he's responsible for our water, the LA Aqueduct, for goodness sake. But the San Francisco Dam disaster, the largest man-made disaster in LA history, which was quite literally his fault. Go back to that episode. So nearly 500 people died after he inspected and said it was cool. Yeah, that got him eliminated. He's off the mountain. So who did make the list? I'm looking for a cultural impact that will hopefully stand the test of time, or at least until the 22nd century. And again, I want to reiterate, this is my Mount Rushmore. And I know you're going to have feedback. So you know the drill. Every Friday we release the episode. I put up a post, Instagram, TikTok. Make sure you comment. Tell me who I omitted. Tell me who I didn't talk about. Tell me why I'm an idiot. I don't care. You know, I love it. And just send me a DM if you want. I always respond to DMs. So you know I'm here for you on this one. So without further ado, let's get to the Mount Rushmore. Well, first, here's a list of who didn't make the Mount Rushmore, but was in contention till the very end. Bob Hope. Not only was he an entertainer, worldwide figure, but he's very responsible, not just from Toluca Lake to San Fernando, but he expanded the valley. He had an impact outside of entertainment worldwide, but no, didn't make it. Griffith J. Griffith. The man who donated the land that became Griffith Park and the Griffith Observatory. Huge impact. But he shot his wife in the face, and I'm just not okay with that. Mike Davis, who perhaps wrote the most important book on modern Los Angeles, City of Quartz, opened my eyes in Sociology 101 at UCLA. It was the text. And it really made me think of UCLA, of Los Angeles in a different context. But nah, he's a little bit too curmudgeonly, a little bit too cynical for my taste. Off the list. Snoop Dogg. Really, really wanted to include Snoop. He went from public enemy number one to the most beloved grandpa in America without even changing his personality. This guy's Mr. LA, but didn't make the list. Kobe Bryant. You see his murals all over LA, all over the world. Kobe. Kids, 6 years old, throw some in the trash can. They say, Kobe. But you know what? I love the man, love what he represented, but can't be on my Mount Rushmore. Nicolas Martinez, the first street vendor in Los Angeles history. Super impactful. Didn't make the list. Raul Martinez, no relation. Immigrant, American dream story. First taquero, pioneer of the taco truck, the food truck. Didn't make Mount Rushmore. Huell Hauser, one of my idols. Nope. Magic Johnson. Sorry, Magic. I want to have you on the podcast one day, but for now, you're not on the Mount Rushmore. Roy Choi. God, Kogi. Amazing. Changed the way we eat. Again, Los Angeles and beyond, but just not enough of a lasting impact at this point. But Roy, again, if you're listening, I want you on the podcast. But you're not on the Mount Rushmore. Biddy Mason was going to be on the Mount Rushmore. This was an African-American landowner in the middle of the 19th century, one of the most wealthy people in LA. Again, as a black person in that era, 70, 80 years before civil rights. But she didn't make it because rule number one had to be alive in the 20th century. She died in 1891. Richie Valens. What a story. La Bamba, Pacoima, plane crash, died 17 years old. Without Richie Valens, we don't have Los Lobos. We don't have War. First superstar Mexican-American entertainer. But just didn't live long enough, frankly, to be on the Mount Rushmore. Amelia Earhart, lost forever in one of the biggest aviation mysteries. First woman, first person to circumnavigate the globe in a plane. Los Angeles was a pioneer city of aviation, and she was at the heart of it. She lived in Toluca Lake, but not quite enough of an impact to be on Mount Rushmore. And then there's Ruth Handler, who invented Barbie, the biggest selling single figurine toy of all time. Barbie, we're talking about. Mattel, El Segundo, she was the founder. But no, not on the Mount Rushmore. And the toughest omission of all, Vin Scully. I have a microphone, bobblehead, if you will, of Vin Scully in my office. have an autographed canceled check of Vin Scully, frame photo, truly an LA icon, grew with the city, helped us grow with the city. But he's not on my Mount Rushmore. So then who is? Who is the Mount Rushmore of Los Angeles, according to In a Minute with Evan Lovett?
Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas is styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
Testing season is right around the corner, and this is when confidence really matters. When kids take time to review key concepts and strengthen their skills before assessments, it can make all the difference. IXL helps reinforce what they're learning right now, so they walk into every test feeling prepared, capable, and confident. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, designed for students from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL delivers personalized, interactive practice that adapts to your child's level and pace. It's an easy, effective way to support learning as the school year heads into its final stretch. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about. Like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW, let us surprise you.
Finding the right furniture for my home can be hard, especially when I'm looking for trendy, high-quality pieces that won't break the bank. Luckily, at Bob's Discount Furniture, I can shop the latest styles and customer favorites with tons of five-star reviews, like Bob's Real Marble Elm Dining Set, which has over 600 five-star reviews, the Copper Radiance Mattress, which over 400 Bob's customers say will give you five-star sleep, the ultra-comfy Phantom Reclining Sofa, which boasts over 1,000 five-star reviews, and the customizable modular Bob's Sectional, which not only costs just $250 per piece, but has over 1,700 five-star reviews. So when you're ready to score five-star style for every room in your home at everyday low prices, listen to the smartest shoppers around and stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Figure number one to get your chisel into the rock. Walt Disney. That's right. Walt Disney was born in Chicago, and his family moved to Missouri when he was 4 years old. And even as a little boy, he would draw. He would copy front page cartoons. And that planted the seeds of what would become, well, Disney, the most famous, recognizable, fun-loving company in the history of the world. Soon they moved to Kansas City, where he continued drawing, making little pictures and cartoons. But he was also introduced to the world of vaudeville and what were called motion pictures, movies. He also attended courses at an art institute and took a correspondence course in cartooning, pushing ahead. In high school, he was a cartoonist of his school newspaper. And by 1918, he attempted to join the army to fight against the Germans, but he was too young. What did he do? He forged the date of birth on his birth certificate and joined the Red Cross anyway as an ambulance driver. And he was shipped to France. But alas, the war was over. But he did draw cartoons on the side of the ambulance for decoration and had some of those cartoons published in an army newspaper. So he went back home, returned to Kansas City, and he began an animated film business with his old mentor, Ube Iwerks. And he produced animated cartoons called Laugh-O-Grams for local movie theaters, which had some success. They'd show them before the movies, and they were cartoons, and people loved them. But he also made a short film called Alice's Wonderland, which was part live action, live child actor interacting with animated characters. But after it was released in 1923, the studio, his Laugh-O-Gram studio, went bankrupt. So he left to join his brother Roy, right here in Los Angeles. And Walt was a convincing kind of fellow. He convinced Iwerks and other artists to join him. And what's funny is the Alice's Wonderland actually became a hit, even after Laugh-O-Gram had went bankrupt and he moved to L.A., because a New York film distributor purchased it and signed him to a contract to create six of these Alice comedies with an option for two more. So Walt convinced Roy, his brother, to risk $250, big money at the time. And they'd pursue the films, and they'd pursue their dreams. And they founded Disney Brothers Studios on October 16th, 1923. In 1925, they moved the studio to Silver Lake, which became known as the Hyperion Studio. And that would eventually become known as Walt Disney Studio. And that's when they found the rabbit's foot, the lucky rabbit's foot, literally, because they created Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. It's a breakout hit when it debuted in 1927, and they produced 25 cartoons featuring the black and white big-eared bunny. But the problem is, Disney didn't own the rights to Oswald. The distributor had him, and he was poaching their animators to crank out more Oswald cartoons without the Disneys. So Walt had to pivot, and he created a mischievous mouse inspired by an actual mouse that used to run around the old Laugh-O-Gram studios. And he made an 8-minute film featuring this mouse. He called it Steamboat Willie. Steamboat Willie. And the star of that film was, well, Mickey Mouse, who made his debut 1928, which also introduced synchronized sound to what had been a silent medium. And now, a New York agent offered Walt $300 to license Mickey Mouse's image, but kept Walt with the rights this time. And that's when the business really took off. Mickey Mouse dolls, dishes, lunchboxes, toothbrushes, radios, figurines. Sound familiar? Yeah, this was the template. By 1930, the first Mickey Mouse book and comic strip were published, and Disney was off to the races. Now, Disney had pioneered the sound film technology. Recorded speech, music, sound effects. And they were also the first to use the Technicolor process. So they produced a film called Flowers and Trees, which won the Academy Award in 1932. And it was the first film. It was a short. It won the Academy for Animated Short. But it was the first to bring full color to animation. And again, Walt Disney just forging ahead, blazing a path, changing the world. And in 1937... Walt took another major step, made a huge gamble. He took out a mortgage on his house, and he financed a $1.4 million picture. Again, astronomical at the time, especially for an animated picture. It was called Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And skeptics called it Disney's folly. How could you spend that much money on an animated film? What a loss. He's going to be a loser, bankrupt. Yeah, Walt had the last laugh. That received an Academy Award in 1939, and it would become the highest grossing movie of its time. So that, the success from Snow White, allowed Disney to build a new, larger studio on Buena Vista Street in Burbank, where the Walt Disney Company remains headquartered to this day. Now, the rest you might know. In the 1950s, Disney expanded the amusement park industry, Disneyland, opened in 1955 in Anaheim. He diversified into TV, Mickey Mouse Club. He also was involved in planning the 1959 Moscow Fair, the 1960 Olympics, the 1964 New York's World Fair. And by 1965, he developed another theme park, Disney World, the heart of which was going to be a new type of city, the Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow, or Epcot. But unfortunately, Disney was a heavy smoker throughout his life, and he died of lung cancer in 1966 before Disney World, that is, or Epcot were completed. But Disney's legacy is obvious and probably as large as any man in world history. Well, any modern man, I should say. To put some numbers on it, there are now 12 Disney theme parks, and Disney, the company, grossed $82 billion in revenue in 2022. And the company has 220,000 employees. That's because of Walt Disney. Now that is a face to be carved into the Mount Rushmore of Los Angeles. Up next, we have one of my favorites. Art LeBeau. As Los Angeles was coming to its own in the mid-20th century, LA was a pretty racist and damn segregated city. It's divided by topography, neighborhoods, race, and class. But it was Art LeBeau that united the youth of Los Angeles and became the broadcasting legend that still, even posthumously, has an impact in Los Angeles. You don't believe me? Just cruise Whittier Boulevard in East LA or Van Nuys Boulevard on a Sunday night. Some say he helped spawn lowrider culture and is emblematic of car culture, which really, more than any culture, defines Los Angeles. So LeBeau was born in Utah, right outside Salt Lake City, 1925. He was born to Armenian immigrants that were observant Mormons. And his father came to the U.S. from the Ottoman Empire. Talk about an American dream story. When LeBeau was 13, his parents divorced, and he moved to South Central L.A., where he would live with his sister and attend George Washington High School. And in 1938, he began to experiment with amateur radio from his bedroom. He loved it. It was a hobby. It was a passion. And graduated from high school, went to Stanford, and joined the Navy. And that's when he made his radio debut. In 1943, while serving in the Navy, he was on KSAN in San Francisco. And that's where he pioneered the request and dedication concept. He would take phone calls from listeners on air while playing records late at night. And the technology wasn't the same as it is now. He'd repeat to the listeners what the person on the phone was saying because technology couldn't put them both on at the same time. But the audience loved it. Now, I don't know if there was any sleepy or crazy legs back then, but he quickly discovered that a prime segment of his audience were young women who would call in to dedicate songs to husbands, boyfriends, and brothers in the military. And that's a tradition that not just carried on, but became the status quo for radio. I mean, I don't think we realize how important that was in developing the relationship between listener and DJ. And that's what really helped music grow. It helped put faces and feelings into the music as sort of a narrative. I think that's a very underrated aspect of his legacy. But his legacy was made even stronger because he was one of the first DJs anywhere to play both black and white artists. He did not discriminate when listeners called to request a song live on air. He was one of the first to allow people of different races to make a request. Now, again, this is a racist time, but Art LeBeau, the music, is colorblind. And he used to have his own show. He was one of the first to have a live radio show. It was a place called Scrivener's Drive-In in Hollywood. Teenagers would come to the drive-in and hang out, give live dedications for the songs. And he'd start making a list of the most frequently requested songs. I'm going to come back to that. Because while taking those requests, the national craze called rock and roll was starting to make its first move. We're talking Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard. It was just reaching L.A., but he was the first DJ to play rock and roll in the West Coast airwaves because he listened to those listeners. He listened to the people. And that's what made Art LeBeau. He was a man of the people. And he advanced. He was into doo-wop and R&B and became a local celebrity. And by the late 1950s, he had the highest rated show on LA radio. And he was a promotional destination. He was one of the first to really elevate this new brand of pop stardom. And he was so big, so impactful, that when Elvis first came to Hollywood, guess who got the exclusive interview? The only interview Elvis gave in LA in his first trip. Yeah, that's right. Art LeBeau. Remember I just talked about making a list of those requested songs? This is going to sound so basic, but he assembled the first album in American history to feature hits by different artists. A compilation album. Art LeBeau was the first one. It's called Oldies But Goodies. And that album stayed in the Billboard Top 100 for over 3 years and inspired generations of, I'm not even going to say copycats, but that was just a thing. And it was an awesome thing. I mean, we used to all make mixtapes, but compilation albums. Art LeBeau. That's right. And now listen to this. He used to host dance shows, but he moved them out to El Monte because the city of LA didn't allow public dances for patrons under 18. So he's like, let's go to El Monte. I want everybody in. And El Monte drew a diverse slate of teenagers from all over. And more importantly, the atmosphere inside the stadium was one of tolerance. Interracial dating, interracial dancing, even though the city of LA didn't yet share those same feelings. It was unacceptable in many neighborhoods, but not when Art LeBeau was around. So finally, by 1981, the city of LA actually declared Art LeBeau Day, and he received his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame right at the corner of Hollywood and Highland. And he kept working, kept doing dedications, kept being a fixture on the radio, in lowriders, in cars, Sunday nights, all over Los Angeles. And up until he passed away in 2022 at 97 years old, he still had a weekly show on K-Day, the Art LeBeau Connection Show, 97 years old. And that, my friends, is what qualifies Art LeBeau for a carved out spot on the mountain. Number two on the Mount Rushmore of Los Angeles. So we are only a week out from the Moon Festival, folks. That's the Mid-Autumn Festival, one of the most important holidays in Chinese and Chinese-American culture. The popularity is on par with that of the Chinese New Year, and the history dates back over 3,000 years. This is going to be on September 17th. So celebrate the Moon Festival with Kiwa Bakery. And at Kiwa Bakery, they're known for their mooncakes. Mooncakes are the consummate gift for the Moon Festival. And their supreme mooncakes are crafted with the finest quality ingredients. I've had some. They're walnuts, lotus paste, red bean paste. They have custard ones. You can taste the love and tradition in every bite. And what the mooncakes are, they're an offering to give your closest friends and family. And now you can get one for yourself, too. Experience the authentic flavors and share the joy of the Moon Festival. That's Kiwa Bakery, kiwa.us. Order yours today or head over to Kiwa Bakery with 4 locations in LA. Tell them LA in a Minute sent you. Kiwa Bakery, where tradition meets quality. Next up is a man that I've talked about quite a bit personally on LA in a Minute, even here on In a Minute with Evan Lovett. And it's somebody that probably impacted me most profoundly of those on my Mount Rushmore. Maybe of anybody. To be fully honest, aside from my dad and my mom, and my wife, and my son, Jonathan Gold. Maybe best known as the first and only food writer to win a Pulitzer. But for me, and for people in LA, what Jonathan Gold did was he opened the door on cultures and community. And he tied the fabric of Los Angeles together through his writing. Oh, his writing. It was so beautiful. I mean, on the surface, it was about food and restaurants. He did a great job, and he had that insight, and he had that palate. But the stories were about the people, the neighborhoods, the culture. And most of all, they're about Los Angeles, the city that we love so much. That's where he was born. Jonathan Gold was born in 1960 to a Jewish father who was a probation officer. And a mom who was a high school teacher and librarian. And Jonathan Gold worked at a restaurant in high school and put himself into UCLA, where he studied art and music. And while he was at UCLA, that's when he began working at the LA Weekly, which, by the way, had a humongous impact culturally in the 80s and even into the 90s. He was a proofreader. He met his future wife, Lori Ochoa. And I bring that up because she's both still impactful for the LA Times and in the LA culinary scene, but she'd also have a huge impact on his career. But what was really the beginning of Gold's legacy was when he started working at the LA Weekly. He said he only had one clearly articulated ambition. Keep in mind, this guy's going to UCLA, but he said his goal, his ambition, was to eat at least once at every restaurant on Pico Boulevard, starting with the fried yuca dish served at a pupuseria near downtown and working methodically westward towards the chili fries at Tom's Number 5 near the beach. How LA is that? Come on. By the mid-1980s, Gold wasn't just a proofreader anymore. He was an editor in the LA Weekly's music section. Yeah, not just talking about food here. He initially was writing about classical music, but he dove into different genres, including hip-hop. We're talking mid-1980s, still like, ooh, hip-hop, raps, this bad thing, all these curse words. And he covered the early days of gangsta rap, including a landmark piece that put NWA on the cover of LA Weekly and made the gangsta rap forefront of conversation in the United States. And how important is that in retrospect to Los Angeles? So it's about this time at LA Weekly that he started his first food column, called it Counterintelligence, where he'd review not white tablecloth Michelin-caliber restaurants, but under-the-radar mom-and-pop spots, what were called, quote-unquote, ethnic restaurants at the time. And that's really the legacy that started defining Los Angeles, because you could go back and read these reviews. He has a book now, or he had a book that was published right before 9/11, 2001, called Counterintelligence, where you read these reviews of places that aren't even around anymore. And it's not even, it is talking about the food, but you're talking about the culture. You're talking about the people. You're talking about the city. I can't express that enough. And in 1992, he wrote an article about the LA uprising for the LA Weekly that was so raw and so powerful that it was revisited 20 years later by the LA Times. And it showed that these were the city's wounds, the city's scars. And they had eventually begun to heal, but he wrote about it with such eloquence and such emotion that even now you feel it and you feel yourself there and you feel why his work was so important. And so Gold eventually went on to California Magazine, Los Angeles Magazine, Blender, Spin, Rolling Stone, Details, even moved to New York for a couple years to be a restaurant critic for Gourmet Magazine. But remember I just mentioned his wife-to-be, his wife, Lori Ochoa? Well, when Jonathan Gold was living in New York, she was named editor of the LA Weekly. She said, Jonathan, come move back to LA. Let's do counterintelligence again. So he did. And he published his best restaurants list. Jonathan Gold's 99 essential LA restaurants. And now remember, at this point, LA food wasn't taken seriously. We didn't have enough five-star restaurants. We didn't have enough Michelin restaurants. But he pushed and pushed. For tacos, for kebab, for Korean barbecue, for baklava, whatever it is. We had it here in Los Angeles, and he made sure that you knew about it. And he made sure that you knew about the people behind it and the neighborhoods and the culture. In 2007, he was recognized. He won that Pulitzer. And finally, in 2012, when Ochoa went back to the LA Times, Gold went to the LA Times, where he went on to win James Beard Awards, the highest award you could get in the food space for writing. I mean, a Pulitzer is a different stratosphere. But even Anthony Bourdain described Gold as the first guy to change the focus from white tablecloth restaurants to really cool little places in strip malls. And by 2015, they made a documentary about Jonathan Gold, City of Gold, which premiered at Sundance to a standing ovation. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It is incredible. By 2018, Gold was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, a really aggressive form of cancer, and he died within a month, 57 years old, and his remains were interred at Hollywood Forever with a tombstone that says appropriately, Tacos Forever. And now, how important was he to the city? After he died, several buildings, including City Hall, were lit up in gold as a tribute to his memory. And there was a new award given by the city, the Jonathan Gold Local Voice Award, honoring writers who are telling stories of their cities, just as Jonathan continually shone a light on his beloved Los Angeles. It's difficult to overstate Gold's impact on the culture of Los Angeles. And I want to refer you, after this episode, of course, go back to episode 40, the 26-minute mark, Jonathan Gold's description of a taco, to really understand his writing and what it means to Los Angeles. I'm going to read a little bit of it. You might actually strike up a conversation with your fellow devotees of the taco one of these days. It's easy to sense something in common with the rest of that shift, though it's true that the commonality often expresses itself in a certain furtiveness around the eyes. If not for the certainty that all is beautiful and holy about the mess of corn and gristle in front of you that would dissipate as soon as you said hello. If you've been there, you know that that elusive fire energy of tacos, vanishes seconds after the tacos are served. And unless you're at a first-class taco spot, you'll never experience it at all. So yeah, here at In a Minute with Evan Lovett, that's the stuff that gets you carved into the Mount Rushmore of Los Angeles. Jonathan Gold, forever. Tacos, forever. Well, the Mount Rushmore has four faces. We've gone through three. And I mentioned that this is episode 42. And I don't think any man deserves that number one spot. Number four, chronologically, but the number one spot more than Jackie Robinson. Number 42. Jack Roosevelt Robinson, in fact, was born into a family of sharecroppers in Georgia, the youngest of five children. His middle name, Roosevelt, honored former President Theodore Roosevelt, who died 25 days before Jackie was born. Unfortunately, Jackie's father left the family in 1920, so they moved cross-country to Pasadena to live with extended family. And they lived on two small houses as an extended family at 121 Pepper Street. I believe it still stands. My very good friend Josh from above Los Angeles, I believe he told me that. But Jackie Robinson's mother worked odd jobs to support the family, and they grew up in relative poverty. And if you know Pasadena, it's an otherwise affluent community. It's different, and there are historic and hidden neighborhoods there, but Pasadena was still Pasadena. So Robinson and his other African-American friends were excluded from many recreational opportunities, and he joined a gang. But luckily, his friend said, Jackie, you have much bigger things ahead in life, and please leave the gang. Luckily, Jackie listened. So he went to Washington Junior High and then enrolled in John Muir High School. And everybody recognized just how athletic and determined Jackie was. So they inspired him to pursue sports. Oh, now that was a good move. Robinson played football, basketball, baseball, track and field, tennis, all at Muir High. And tennis might have been his best sport. In 1936, he won the boys' singles championship for the whole Pacific Coast in the Pacific Coast Negro Tennis Tournament. That's what it was called. But after high school, he attended Pasadena Junior College. He left tennis behind and he continued playing the other four sports. But he set records. He lettered. He started. And he was one of 10 students named to the Order of the Mast and Dagger, which was awarded to students who perform outstanding service to the school and whose scholastic and citizenship record is worthy of recognition. Those were the seeds of the greatness that would become Jackie Robinson. But there was an incident there at junior college that illustrated his impatience with authority figures that he perceived as racist, which was a character trait that would resurface repeatedly and importantly in his life. He was arrested after vocally disputing the detention of one of his black friends by police. Now, luckily, he received a 2-year suspended sentence, but that incident gave Jackie a reputation for combativeness in the face of racial antagonism, for standing up with himself. He developed a reputation, but it would prove to serve him more than it would prove to hurt him. And in 1939, he went to UCLA, where he was the first athlete ever to win letters in four sports. Again, baseball, basketball, track, football. But by 1941, he withdrew from UCLA to help his mom care for the family. And he moved to Hawaii to play semi-pro football and work in construction to earn money. 1942, he entered the Army and he became a second lieutenant. But he was court-martialed. He refused to follow an order to sit at the back of the military bus. Again, that reputation was true, but it was strong and it was good. And charges were dismissed and he earned an honorable discharge. But it was foreshadowing his future activism and his commitment to civil rights. So when he left the Army, he played professional baseball with the Kansas City Monarchs in the Negro Leagues, where he starred and he drew the attention of the president and GM of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Branch Rickey. Now, Branch Rickey had been planning to integrate baseball, but he was looking for the right candidate. And Jackie's skills on the field, his integrity, his family-oriented lifestyle, they all appealed greatly to Branch Rickey. But his main fear was that reputation. Would Jackie be able to withstand the imminent racist abuse without responding in a way that would hurt integration's chances for success? So one of the first times Rickey met Jackie face-to-face, he shouted insult after him, trying to be certain that Jackie could accept the taunts without incident. Jackie remained strong-willed, strong-browed. In 1945, Rickey signed Robinson to play on a Dodger minor league team, the Montreal Royals. Well, he dominated the minor leagues. He led that league in batting average. And he was called up to the Dodgers in 1947. An immediate success. Led the National League in stolen bases. Won the Rookie of the Year award. 2 years later, won a batting championship. Was the MVP. But personally, it was a struggle, to say the least. Fans would hurl bottles. Racist epithets. Some Dodger teammates protested against having to play with an African-American teammate. Some opposing players threw balls at him at his head. They'd spike him when they're sliding into a base. And even some important people in the front offices were unsupportive of Robinson. In the MLB front office, they were unsupportive. Players on the Cardinals threatened to strike if Jackie Robinson took the field. Luckily, the commissioner, Ford Frick, quashed the strike and said any player who did would be suspended from baseball. And in a touching move, Dodger captain Pee Wee Reese left his position on the field and put an arm around Jackie in a show of solidarity when the heckling became intolerable. And Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson became lifelong friends. However, those ugly remarks, death threats, and Jim Crow laws that forbade a black player from staying in hotels or eating restaurants with the rest of the team, his experience in the major leagues was tough. It was heavy. It was bleak. It weighed on him personally. So he retired after 10 years with a lifetime average of 311 and 6 National League championships and 1 World Series win. He was known as one of the best and most scary base runners of all time. This guy was awesome. I mean, an awesome baseball player, not just for what he accomplished, but his actual baseball talent. And so he retired in 1957. And he engaged in business and civil rights activism. He became a spokesman for the NAACP, made appearances with MLK. And in 1962, he was the first African-American inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, Robinson passed away in 1972. His autobiography was called, appropriately, I Never Had It Made. It was a struggle, but he was truly a hero. And in 1984, he was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor for an American civilian. And in 1997, on the 50th anniversary of breaking the color barrier, the commissioner of baseball, Bud Selig, retired Robinson's jersey number 42. Players had their jerseys retired by teams previously, but for the entire league, that was unprecedented. And by 2004, there was a Jackie Robinson Day. And that's when Ken Griffey Jr., the superstar of superstars in baseball, received permission from the commissioner to wear number 42 on Jackie Robinson Day. And finally, by 2009, all players wear number 42 on April 15th to commemorate Jackie Robinson and his legacy, not just to Los Angeles, not just to baseball, but to the world. And Jackie Robinson came right here from Los Angeles. Now that, my friends, is a legacy. One that gets you immortality forever on my Mount Rushmore of Los Angeles. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett. Please leave a 5-star rating and a review on whatever platform you use. That really helps the show grow. And I appreciate you tuning in each week. Do not forget to share the show with a friend that loves LA. I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for this city. And thank you for listening to In a Minute with Evan Lovett. All right, y'all. It's been a minute.
Calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas is styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
Testing season is right around the corner, and this is when confidence really matters. When kids take time to review key concepts and strengthen their skills before assessments, it can make all the difference. IXL helps reinforce what they're learning right now, so they walk into every test feeling prepared, capable, and confident. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts. Designed for students from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL delivers personalized, interactive practice that adapts to your child's level and pace. It's an easy, effective way to support learning as the school year heads into its final stretch. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Hi, it's Sierra Miller. I can't wait for you to check out my new collection of shoes and accessories at Designer Shoe Warehouse. If you love shoes as much as I do, then trust me, I got you. From cute sneakerinas to the perfect flip-flops to stunning heels, these shoes are all style, no drama. It's a girl's girl summer, and DSW has just the shoes. Shop the Sierra Miller collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
When I'm looking for high-quality furniture that doesn't break the bank, I don't have to settle for subpar styles because I can find everything I need at Bob's Discount Furniture. At Bob's, I can score everyday low prices on pieces that real customers love, like Consumer Reports recommended mattresses, real marble dining sets, and the best-selling modular Bob's sectional, which has over 1,700 five-star reviews. So stock up on five-star style and visit Bob's, where America shops for furniture.
Why have I asked my electrician I found on Angie.com to bury my pet hamster Nibbles in our yard for me? Because I was so moved by how carefully he buried my electrical wires, I knew I could trust him to bury my sweet Nibbles after his untimely end. Nibbles, gone too soon. May he scurry in peace.
Hey, sorry about your pet, but I just wire stuff.
Nibbles would have loved you like a brother.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Well, Mount Rushmore has four faces. We've gone through three. And I mentioned that this is episode 42. And I don't think any man deserves that number one spot. Number four, chronologically, but the number one spot more than Jackie Robinson. Number 42. Jack Roosevelt Robinson, in fact, was born into a family of sharecroppers in Georgia, the youngest of five children. His middle name, Roosevelt, honored former President Theodore Roosevelt, who died 25 days before Jackie was born. Unfortunately, Jackie's father left the family in 1920, so they moved cross-country to Pasadena to live with extended family. And they lived on two small houses as an extended family at 121 Pepper Street. Believe it still stands. My very good friend Josh from above Los Angeles, I believe he told me that. But Jackie Robinson's mother worked odd jobs to support the family, and they grew up in relative poverty. And if you know Pasadena, it's an otherwise affluent community. It's different. And they're historic and hidden neighborhoods there, but Pasadena was still Pasadena. So Robinson and his other African-American friends were excluded from many recreational opportunities. And he joined a gang. But luckily, his friend said, "Jackie, you have much bigger things ahead in life, and please leave the gang." Luckily, Jackie listened. So he went to Washington Junior High and then enrolled in John Muir High School. And everybody recognized just how athletic and determined Jackie was. So they inspired him to pursue sports. Oh, now that was a good move. Robinson played football, basketball, baseball, track and field, tennis, all at Muir High. And tennis might have been his best sport. In 1936, he won the boys' singles championship for the whole Pacific Coast in the Pacific Coast Negro Tennis Tournament. That's what it was called. But after high school, he attended Pasadena Junior College. He left tennis behind and he continued playing the other four sports. But he set records. He lettered. He started. And he was one of 10 students named to the Order of the Mast and Dagger, which was awarded to students who perform outstanding service to the school and whose scholastic and citizenship record is worthy of recognition. Those were the seeds of the greatness that would become Jackie Robinson. But there was an incident there at junior college that illustrated his impatience with authority figures that he perceived as racist, which was a character trait that would resurface repeatedly and importantly in his life. He was arrested after vocally disputing the detention of one of his black friends by police. Now, luckily, he received a 2-year suspended sentence, but that incident gave Jackie a reputation for combativeness in the face of racial antagonism, for standing up with himself. He developed a reputation, but it would prove to serve him more than it would prove to hurt him. And in 1939, he went to UCLA, where he was the first athlete ever to win letters in four sports. Again, baseball, basketball, track, football. But by 1941, he withdrew from UCLA to help his mom care for the family. And he moved to Hawaii to play semi-pro football and work in construction to earn money. 1942, he entered the Army and he became a second lieutenant. But he was court-martialed. He refused to follow an order to sit at the back of the military bus. Again, that reputation was true, but it was strong and it was good. And charges were dismissed and he earned an honorable discharge. But it was foreshadowing his future activism and his commitment to civil rights. So when he left the Army, he played professional baseball with the Kansas City Monarchs in the Negro Leagues, where he starred and he drew the attention of the president and GM of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Branch Rickey. Now, Branch Rickey had been planning to integrate baseball, but he was looking for the right candidate. And Jackie's skills on the field, his integrity, his family-oriented lifestyle, they all appealed greatly to Branch Rickey. But his main fear was that reputation. Would Jackie be able to withstand the imminent racist abuse without responding in a way that would hurt integration's chances for success? So one of the first times Rickey met Jackie face to face, he shouted insult after him, trying to be certain that Jackie could accept the taunts without incident. Jackie remained strong-willed, strong-browed. In 1945, Rickey signed Robinson to play on a Dodger minor league team, the Montreal Royals. Well, he dominated the minor leagues. He led that league in batting average. And he was called up to the Dodgers in 1947. An immediate success. Led the National League in stolen bases. Won the Rookie of the Year award. 2 years later, won a batting championship. Was the MVP. But personally, it was a struggle, to say the least. Fans would hurl bottles. Racist epithets. Some Dodger teammates protested against having to play with an African-American teammate. Some opposing players threw balls at him at his head. They'd spike him when they're sliding into a base. And even some important people in the front offices were unsupportive of Robinson. In the MLB front office, they were unsupportive. Players on the Cardinals threatened to strike if Jackie Robinson took the field. Luckily, the commissioner, Ford Frick, quashed the strike and said any player who did would be suspended from baseball. And in a touching move, Dodger captain Pee Wee Reese left his position on the field and put an arm around Jackie in a show of solidarity when the heckling became intolerable. And Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson became lifelong friends. However, those ugly remarks, death threats, and Jim Crow laws that forbade a black player from staying in hotels or eating restaurants with the rest of the team, his experience in the major leagues was tough. It was heavy. It was bleak. It weighed on him personally. So he retired after 10 years with a lifetime average of 311 and six National League championships and one World Series win. He was known as one of the best and most scary base runners of all time. This guy was awesome. I mean, an awesome baseball player, not just for what he accomplished, but his actual baseball talent. And so he retired in 1957. And he engaged in business and civil rights activism. He became a spokesman for the NAACP, made appearances with MLK. And in 1962, he was the first African-American inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, Robinson passed away in 1972. His autobiography was called appropriately, "I Never Had It Made." It was a struggle, but he was truly a hero. And in 1984, he was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor for an American civilian. And in 1997, on the 50th anniversary of breaking the color barrier, the Commissioner of Baseball, Bud Selig, retired Robinson's jersey number 42. Players had their jerseys retired by teams previously, but for the entire league, it was unprecedented. And by 2004, there was a Jackie Robinson Day. And that's when Ken Griffey Jr., the superstar of superstars in baseball, received permission from the commissioner to wear number 42 on Jackie Robinson Day. And finally, by 2009, all players wear number 42 on April 15th to commemorate Jackie Robinson and his legacy, not just to Los Angeles, not just to baseball, but to the world. And Jackie Robinson came right here from Los Angeles. Now that, my friends, is a legacy. One that gets you immortality forever on my Mount Rushmore of Los Angeles. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett. Please leave a 5-star rating and a review on whatever platform you use. That really helps the show grow. And I appreciate you tuning in each week. Do not forget to share the show with a friend that loves LA. I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for this city. And thank you for listening to In a Minute with Evan Lovett. All right, y'all. It's been a minute.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Diamond Dynasty has all new Red Diamond cards and World Baseball Classic content in MLB The Show 26. Collect your favorites and compete against the best. MLB The Show 26 is available now on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series XS, and Nintendo Switch. Rated E for everyone. Officially licensed by MLB Players, Inc.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Identity Refreshing!
When equipment breaks down and operations come to a halt, every single second counts. So why is your maintenance team spending 60% of their time doing anything but turning wrenches? Maintain X is the AI-powered maintenance and asset management system that helps your team get back to actually fixing breakdowns. No more searching for manuals. No more hunting down parts. No more drowning in paperwork. With Maintain X, your team can access manuals from anywhere, create new procedures in minutes, and turn voice notes into clear and complete work order feedback. What used to take hours now only takes minutes. Keep your operations moving and your wrenches turning. Join over 13,000 maintenance teams that are already fixing more and filing less. Try MaintainX for free today. Go to MaintainX.com/AI. That's Maintain and the letter X.com/AI.